Is Margot Gore real too?
Well, our daily routine at Hatfield, we all lived either in nearby hotels or flats, and we would report to the operations room. We had very small accommodation at Hatfield, and we'd have an operations officer who would have received from sort of the central place where the movement of aircraft was being controlled at Andover. They would have a list of aircraft that had to be moved from Hatfield. We were mostly clearing Hatfield, either up to the Midlands to High Urkel or up to Silloth or Kirkbride or Dumfries or somewhere. And then we would be given a chit which would have the aircraft number, and it was in duplicate. And then you'd collect a weather report from somewhere, and collect your bag and your kit. You only had a small overnight bag. And then you'd go out and get into the aircraft with your maps, having made out your route as to how you thought you were going to fly. We mostly flew on our own. Sometimes two or three of us would go together, and one would lead and the rest would follow. But mostly we went. We weren't all going to the same place, so we would go off on our own. And you'd have to have made a flight plan to yourself, that you might have had to land somewhere to refuel on the way, and then the weather might turn bad on you. You might have to get stuck for a night or even two nights, or you might go right through in the day. In the winter, it was perishingly cold.
Were you flying open cockpit?
Yes. The Tiger Moth was an open machine in the early days. We'd have a Sidcup suit, which was a thick suit, and a flying helmet and goggles. And some of us had fur-lined boots too, and we managed to get an issue of boots, because it really was extremely cold. And as you know, the early winters of the war were very, very severe ones too, and there was snow everywhere.
How did you cope with that?
Well, you were very cold. There's no other word. But, I mean, we were young, and we were fit. So, I mean, we were so delighted to be flying that you didn't really mind the discomfort. And then having got, say, to Scotland, then, of course, the problem of getting back. And in the early days, we didn't have return flights. Later on, when we get to more advanced pools, we did have the flights back, but in 1940-41 we'd have to come back by train, and that was an overnight do very often, and that was jolly uncomfortable, and you were very lucky if you managed to get any sandwiches anywhere or any food. And I remember one episode when we were coming down from Scotland. It was after the air raids had started, and there'd been a big raid on London. And our train started to go slower and slower and slower, and the guard came along and said, well, you know, Paddington's been bombed, and there's a big hold-up. We don't know how we're going to get anywhere. So eventually he came along to us. There were about five of us there, I think. And he said, we're just going to go through Watford. And we're crawling along very slow because the line's been bombed ahead. I suggest you jump out, you see. So we said, oh, that'll be fine, because we could then ring up. We weren't all that far from Hatfield, you see. We could be fetched by car. So we got our parachute bags and our overnight bag, and we got to the station, going through it very slowly. We all flung our parachutes and overnight bags out, and then jumped out. And I know I was the last one. I don't know why, but I was the last one to nip out, and only just got onto the platform. And we picked up our bags and got to a telephone and rang up Hatfield, and they sent a car for us. But a lot of the trains were very badly delayed. I mean, Liverpool could have been bombed, and Manchester, Coventry, even Wales. So it was all... That part of our career in the ATA was hard going, because we had slow, open aircraft, long distances, and had to return by train, and it wasn't at all funny.
What else did the war mean to you at this point?
Well, one was... You had friends who were being sent abroad. You had friends who were taken prisoner in Singapore. It was a fair period of death and disaster, I think, because things were going very badly for us, 1940, 1941, indeed into 1942. And you had friends whose husbands were being killed and fiancés were being killed, and you had friends who disappeared and taken prisoner in Singapore, and you didn't know whether they would ever come back again. I think it was a period of very great tension for us. And then, of course, the rationing came in. But this, I don't think, was anything like as bad as people made out. We were very much better fed than we are now. I mean, there was perhaps very little variety, but what we had was plenty. Boring. Limited, but we were not hungry.
So most people weren't dependent upon the black market?
A lot of people, no, you weren't dependent upon the black market. The black market operated in that you got quite a lot of things on the side, but they weren't necessary. They were pleasures rather than necessities. And I think Lord Woolton, who organized the rationing system, did an absolute marvelous job. And it is rather food for thought that the children's teeth were better than they've ever been, and 1,000 times better than they are now in 1986, because they didn't have any sweets. So it's, you know, it's a rather thoughtful thought. But I think the next thing after the hurricane, Pauline Gower sent for me. Must have been in the beginning of September, and she said, we've got too big for Hatfield, and the powers that be have decided that we've got to make at least two other pools, divide up Hatfield. There wasn't room for us there anyway. And how would you feel, she said, if you took on a pool? So I said, well, I don't know anything about it, taking on a pool. Well, she said, the idea is that we take over Hamble. There's a small man's pool there, and they want to post them elsewhere. And if you'd like it, I can send you down there, and you can choose 12 pilots from here. Take who you like. So I had no idea, of course, what I was involving myself in. I thought, well, you know, this might be rather a challenge. So I sat down with a pencil and paper, and I chose my 12 people that I thought would be most useful to me, the least trouble, most use. And then, as we were going to have to fly Blenheims, and yes, Blenheims were the first things, and Hudsons, I had to go to White Waltham and do a conversion course, short one, onto a Blenheim.
Could you describe that?
Well, two of us went. Philippa Bennett, who was one of the girls I had chosen to go with me, she and I went over. And it wasn't all that different to an Oxford, really. There were just more knobs, and it was more powerful. And I don't think either of us had any problems at all in flying it, and I don't think we did very long. I mean, I think I only did perhaps a couple of hours on it, and then my
was it simply a practical test? You didn't have to do
fly
theory.
It. Oh, you have to fly it. Yes, that's all. Oh, yes. I mean, they just give you the handling notes, and the instructor went with you, and you did circuits and bumps until he was satisfied, and then you just did a solo flight, and that was it. And I think I've got in my authorization card probably the date. I think it was somewhere around about September 1941, and then immediately. I went with an operations officer and the 12 that I'd selected.
But what was your opinion of the instructors? How did, because they were men, how did they feel about instructing a woman?
Oh, they didn't mind. No, they didn't mind at all. I mean, we caused no trouble, and we were all rather quite good pilots. We didn't do anything ghastly. So, and I don't think we had any problems at all. Certainly Philippa and I only did a very short time of duel before we went off to Hamble. And we only had a room there, one room, and we used the air service training mess. And the aircraft that we were going to ferry from there were Blenheims, Hudsons, Spitfires, of course, from Eastleigh and Chatties Hill, from Supermarine, Walruses, which were amphibious fleet air arm aircraft, which you could land on water, and had wheels that went down as well. We took them off the land. And they were built at Cowes. So we had to fly over to Cowes to collect them. And then we took them mostly to somewhere called Rorton, which is near Swindon. And that's where they had something done to them there. I don't know what they did. And that's how Hamble started. We started with 12, and they left two men behind, a George Dutton and an Armstrong Payne, just to sort of show us the ropes. And they didn't want to go when the time came. They said, oh, there's no reason why we shouldn't go. We're perfectly happy here. We don't want to go. But they had to. But they stayed with us for about 4 months, just in case there were some hitches and things that we couldn't find the way to. And I think I took my first Spitfire in the next month, in October.
And how did you find that?
Oh, that was the most beautiful aircraft ever. There was just nothing, there's never been anything to compare to it. It was a perfect aircraft.
What was so perfect about it?
Well, it looked beautiful to begin with, and it flew as beautifully as it looked. It had no vices, and you felt it was like a thoroughbred, like a racer. I think everybody felt the same way. It was a sort of love affair almost at once with all of us. They got less nice, the sort of later marks, the Mark 19, 18 and all the rest of it. The first Spitfires had a Merlin engine. The first Mark 1 to Mark 7. And then 8, 9 and 10 had a Griffin engine. And 19. And they were a bit more nose heavy. They lengthened it. It was a bigger engine, and you couldn't run them up with just an aircraftsman lying over the tail to keep the tail down when you ran up the engine to see it was all right before you took off. And you had to have them onto a special starting area with a ring set into concrete and a strap, a webbing strap, over the rear part of the fuselage to keep it down when you open the engine, because they were nose heavy and the engines were more powerful. And then of course the rest of the pilots came down and we gradually increased in number. We got up to 50 in the end, and we moved an enormous number of Spitfires, both from AST, Eastleigh, Chatties Hill. They were all factories. AST were doing conversions and repairs. By that time, the aircraft had been damaged. And I think one of our big excitements there was that one day, in rather bad weather, a German Heinkel popped out of the clouds, machine gunned the tarmac, killed a man on it, and then flew up to Winchester and dropped a bomb. And that caused considerable excitement in that, whereas before, we used to say, aren't the aircraft ready to go, you see, and they would say, no, they're not ready. After the aerodrome had been bombed, they used to ringing up and saying, you know, the aircraft are ready, perhaps you can move them, you see, because we were a target then. So we moved a lot of Blenheims, a lot of Spitfires, a lot of Walruses, Hurricanes, of course, as well. And I think my nastiest moment was taking a Blenheim into Eastleigh, which had a balloon barrage around it. And they had lanes that you went in, Charlie and Harry and all the rest of it. And they were, the lanes are normally hauled down, so you could go in through them. And I was taking a Blenheim in there with an ATC cadet with me for experience for him. He was waiting to go to the Air Force. And an imminent air raid was announced to Balloon Command. In actual fact, aircraft heading for Southampton. And they put the balloons up in my path as I was coming in. And I suddenly saw them rising in front of me, too late to turn away. I just had to go up as quickly as I could. I opened everything up, put the wheels up. And as I'm telling the story, you can realize that I beat the balloons. I got above them. But it was a very, very alarming moment because, you know, it was just a matter of luck that one didn't get a cable.
How did you feel at that
moment? Oh, very frightened, yes, very frightened indeed. I was sweating all over. We did make a big fuss about it because, of course, they should have let me in. I was going to cause quite a lot of damage if I had crashed onto the aerodrome. And they just should have let me in and then put the balloons up behind me. And they changed their rules afterwards. Somebody made a mistake, I think, really, and just sort of pressed the button and didn't realize that there was somebody coming in. I mean, I'd done all the right things. You had to be routed in. I had to get permission to go in, and I had, and I was there at the right time. So they should have let me in. But I think it was the most frightening thing that ever happened to me, because it was very likely that I would have got tangled up and just been brought down on the aerodrome, or on Eastleigh, or on Southampton, you know. Could have done quite a lot of damage. So that excitement. Over the years, we moved over 300,000 aircraft from the area. Fairly short flights. Because they wanted to clear the area, being a very vulnerable area. They wanted to clear it of aircraft and not have them all lined around the airfield. So that's why.
So where were you moving the aircraft to?
We used to get them out of the area, mostly to places like Bryce Norton, Killearn, Rorton, Llandaff in Wales, St Athan, down to Cornwall, up to Cosford, High Ercle. We tended not to go further north than that because they wanted us back to move another aircraft as quickly as possible. And we had taxi aircraft. We had twin-engine Ansons that have up to 12 people in them. We had an ATC cadet as a rule with us to wind the undercarriage up because they were by hand. And we couldn't do it. One thing a woman couldn't do was wind an undercarriage up. Very heavy. And then we had three-seater Fairchilds, American Fairchilds, single-engine little three-seaters. And our junior officers used to bring the Fairchilds to wherever you happen to be, and they'd pick you up and fly you either to another aerodrome to pick up an aeroplane or back to base to pick up another aeroplane. And we could move anything up to 3 or 4 aircraft a day per head, which we had to do sometimes if we had a bad spell of weather when you couldn't move. We were not supposed to fly with a cloud base below 800 feet or visibility less than 2,000 yards or 1,500 yards. So you got a build-up of aircraft, and you used to then have to roll your sleeves up and get going. And move as quickly as possible because they were wanted to have their radios put in and their guns fitted. And by this period I'm talking of now, sort of 42, 43, you know, things were getting fairly hot, so that there was a need for them to be moved rapidly. And then there were some that were called priority one, and they were absolutely, you dropped everything to move them. And over the bombing of Malta and the defense of Malta, we had to move Spitfires in the most appalling weather, because they were down to about one aircraft defending Malta, and we had to move them to anywhere we could get them in, Calern, Rice Norton, Risington, it didn't matter. And then they banged the guns and the radio in, and they were taken on up to Scotland and put onto an aircraft carrier. And the aircraft carrier then went off to the Mediterranean, and they got there absolutely in the nick of time. They flew them off the aircraft carrier.
How did the women feel about flying aircraft in conditions that weren't favourable?
Well, it was very frightening, because, of course, it coincided with the most appalling, terrible weather. I mean, there were about 5 days when we simply couldn't fly. The cloud was absolutely on the deck. And no way, no one could move them. But they were so important that most of the ones that we were moving were at Chattis Hill, which is near Stockbridge. We had to go and sit by car and sit all day. And there was one aircraft would be strapped on its starting point, and we just waited. And I remember the cloud lifted slightly, and it was my aircraft that was on the block. So I leapt in, and we'd started it and ran it up, and I took off from Chattis Hill, which is it was just a dispersal unit. It was a little old racetrack. And as I got into the air, the cloud absolutely came down again. Bonk. I mean, it was only a temporary lift. And I fell back into the aerodrome very gratefully. And that was it. And eventually, I think it was about 2 days later, that we got off. And we had a telegram from Churchill thanking us for our part in the defence of Malta, which was very exciting indeed. But we did have very bad weather down on that bit of coast. And we did very often fly in conditions that were below the minimums laid down. You got caught, you see. I think we only had one pilot who was killed through bad weather, a girl caught on a salmon, who got caught in bad weather and flew into a hillside somewhere near Calern, I think, somewhere near Bath, and was killed. But most of the accidents that we had were engine failures or pilot error of some kind. And we had 4 or 5 people killed.
What were the main hazards of flying?
Oh, weather. Bad weather. Because we had no radio. And the Met Office did not have the facilities. Because of the war, they didn't have the weather stations, the weather ships, as far out into the Atlantic, so that they simply were caught with weather coming which there'd been no report of. You see, normally they had a chain of weather ships right out into the Atlantic, so they could, the radio would bring in information about bad weather coming in. Well, these were limited because of the U-boats. So that they did get caught out very much indeed with the weather. And by 1942 we had our own Met station. We had a WAF and an assistant, WAF officer and an assistant, who they had a teleprinter linked to a weather centre. And we used to get forecasts from them every morning, so that the program would come in overnight. We had an old man who used to spend the night in the pool, and he'd take down all the details of the aircraft that had to be moved next day and put it on an enormous book. And then I would come in, and the operations officers would come in, and we'd make I'd go first of all to the Met Office and get an idea of what they thought was going to happen, and then we would go and make out a programme of who was to fly what and where. And that was one of my jobs, that I had to decide when some pilot was fit to move on to a slightly more complicated aircraft. You didn't put a pilot who had passed a conversion course on to Blenheims and so on. You didn't give them a mosquito straight away. You had to wait until you felt they were fit to fly a mosquito, which was a bit more complicated and a bit
what
faster.
What was the criteria that decided?
My judgment. I had to decide whether I thought that they were the sort of people who could cope and how they'd been coping. It was just my judgment, which was part of the strain of the job, because you can make a mistake. You can think somebody can do something and they can't. And that's all there is to it. Or they may get caught in conditions which you couldn't know were going to happen.
Did you ever make a mistake?
Not really, I don't think. I never really found flying the actual handling of aircraft difficult. I didn't like getting caught in very bad weather. I always used to think I was unquestionably going to lose myself. I didn't, actually. But I always thought I was going to. But I didn't mind actually handling aircraft. You either can or you can't. You know, it's something that's given to you. But I did find the strain told on me of deciding for other people. Didn't mind deciding for myself, but I didn't like deciding for other people.
How did you cope with that sort of pressure?
Well, I suppose the war ended in time, I think. I think sooner or later you can't cope. I think you do break. I was very tired at the end. I think the strain was getting to me, because we were also getting more inexperienced pilots in who hadn't the background, who hadn't done as much flying. And they were more vulnerable.
Who was sending these inexperienced pilots?
Well, they weren't inexperienced. They were inexperienced when they were taken on, so they had less of a background of flying than we earlier ones had. I mean, we'd done quite a lot of flying when we came in. And then by the end, we were getting people posted to us from the RAF who did an ab initio course. They were taught.